This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome, everyone, to Jikoji. We're very happy to have you here. I'd like to say, too, that some of you are here new, and we welcome Jikoji welcomes you, and some of you have been practicing for a long time. Whatever reason you came to, whether it's provisional, just to check things out, or whether you're already on the Buddha way, so to speak, whether you've been practicing a long time, bear in mind that there's no beginning and end to the Buddha way, and there's no high and low to the Buddha way. So those of us that wear robes or have been practicing for a long time, and those of you that just started, it's an equal, totally equal playing field. We're all the same. And everyone who sits down together, like we did this morning, whether they've been sitting down for 50 years or for the first time, they start at the beginning. Everyone starts at the beginning together. Everyone is a beginner together. So bear that in mind, that everything is equal here. And the Buddha way is totally equal. So welcome, everyone, to Jikoji. And today, our guiding teacher, Jikoji's guiding teacher, Nenzen, and myself are going to talk on a very broad issue, existence, which is just about everything.
So as big as it gets.
We're going to talk about everything, so in one way or another. So bear in mind, too, that the Buddha way is comprehensive. So we do meditation, which is what we did this morning, and we also try and live a wholesome ethical life. So we have that aspect about us, and we also come to understanding. In other words, we hear a talk, or we have some insight, or we have some understanding. And that's what we're doing right now. We're having a talk together. We're talking together. We're trying to come to understanding about existence. So I'd like to begin with we have a chant, not the chant we did earlier, but another chant that we do regularly, and it's from a teacher named Dengshang Langji from China, a Tozan Ryokai. And he begins this way: the teachings of thusness, the teachings of as it isness, the teachings of existence itself, of reality itself, is the teaching of this is conveyed to you, is recommended to you by all your ancestors, all the ancestors who have practiced before us. They did it. The Buddha did it. They all recommended it to us. The teachings of reality have been conveyed to you by all your ancestors, your grandmothers, your grandfathers, everything that preceded you, even the plants and the animals, recommends this to you. And then Dengshang says, it's conveyed by intimacy itself, is conveyed intimately. In other words, it's not an idea, it's not a concept, it's not just some words. It's conveyed by direct contact, by directly meeting another person, or directly meeting your own experience, by intimacy, by close proximity. It's conveyed closely, it's conveyed locally. The teachings of reality are not a faraway affair. It's a very close, intimate thing. It's conveyed right here, right now, right with your body and your mind. It's very, very close. It's very intimate. It's so intimate, it's kind of fragile and delicate, but it's very, very close. And then Dongshan says something a little bit more. He says, this intimacy is not something you acquire. It's something you already have. It's something you already are. It's something that you could say is your birthright. It's yours. You own it. It actually is you. And Dongshan says, this intimate thing that you have, this taste of reality, that's close, I advise you to keep it well. Take care of it. Take care of it. When the Buddha, when the original Buddha when the original Buddha was inquiring into existence, the circumstance of his inquiry, he came from a situation, a very privileged situation. His mother had died from complications of his birth. His father, who must have really loved his mother, his wife, was very protective of his son. He was an aristocrat. He was a governor of his clan in northern India. And he overprotected his, you could say he spoiled his son. Wanted to keep him from any harm. I mean, he lost his wife, didn't want to lose his son. He was very protective of his son, and he kept his son from seeing things as they are. But slowly, the Buddha, who was also an extremely intelligent child, realized that this wasn't the whole story, that there was a kind of subtext to this overprotective life he had. And he wanted to find out what was the purpose of existence. What was the meaning of life? Or to put it betterly, how can I lead a meaningful life? And he was trying to solve a problem too. I mean, a problem that exists throughout existence. Like, since we are alive, since we are endowed with this life energy, why is it incomplete? Why is there suffering? Why, along with happiness, does unhappiness exist? What's going on here? What's the story? That was a Buddha's inquiry. Like, what is going on? What is life? You know? And he asked this question. And that was the beginning of his path. For instance, he looked for, in his inquiry, like he looked for who was doing the asking. Who's asking this question of what is life? In other words, what is a self? What is being? And he, in this inquiry of who is doing the asking, what is being, he looked for, at that time there was a what's called an Atman or in the Sanskrit term, the svabhava, which means own being. He looked for a kind of essence within oneself, a self, a personality. In the West, we might call it a soul, or a kind of germinal kind of ownness. That's me, you know, separate from my body, separate from what I think, separate from my feelings, a kind of core meanness. He looked for that. He looked for it. I mean, he looked for it with intense practice. He looked for it. And he didn't find an essence. He found. Remember, he was practicing with what was in front of him. He found there was substantiality, there was a body, there was substance, there was stuff. He found that there was sensation, feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, hot, cold, whatever. There were perceptions, hearing, tasting, touching. There was what you might call mental constructions, imputations, samskara, kind of constructing that based on thought. And then in a kind of broad sense, there's consciousness itself. He found those. They're called skandhas, or five categories of beingness. But he didn't find a self. And that, it sounds strange, but that kind of failure or disappointment, I wouldn't call it disappointment, that kind of failure in finding a germinal self was his awakening. He was, you could say, kind of finished with his inquiry and not finding a self. Actually, he was relieved. So that's kind of the beginning of the Buddha's inquiry into what existence was. And you're going to talk more about non-self, right? And the other two aspects. Yeah. So please continue with.
In Buddhism, this concept of existence, what we're doing all the time, what everything's doing all the time, reality with the big, whole, beautiful mess of existence. In Buddhism, it's characterized by what is known as the three marks of existence. Shoho Roshi just spoke of one, which is anatta, non-self. Buddhism posits that there is no permanent, unchanging self or soul, no I, that is something that you can grab onto and say, here I am, this is me, unchanging, fixed identity. Mm-mm. Instead, there is this ever-changing, ever-flowing physical and mental component, the skandhas. We experience reality through this ever-changing landscape. And this very specifically challenges an idea that was around then and persists now of a fixed identity. I'm very fond of this idea of a flip book. Some of you have heard this before, but you've seen this little cartoon animated, early animation flip books. You go, and you see the characters move. That's me. That's you. That's us. It's just, but it goes on forever. Forever and ever and ever. That's us. Every single little page is us and everything else. So that is non-self. That's one of the three marks of existence. As you can imagine, and take from that non-self, always changing identity, moving reality, moving, the other mark of existence is impermanence. Impermanence, anicca. And as just evidenced by what you were speaking about, no fixed self, there's no fixed anything. Everything is in movement. Everything is in a state of flux. Everything is temporary. Nothing lasts forever. So this understanding encourages us to not try to grab and keep and hold, even though we are wont to do so. Everything's moving. Suffering arises from that. Can I keep it this way, please? Or can I get rid of this, please? And then leading into the third mark of existence now from impermanence is dukkha, which is translated as suffering. I don't know. Sometimes I like the term dissatisfaction or unease, maybe, because it doesn't have to be full-blown suffering. It could just be like, why can't it be the way I want it? Why can't the world be at peace? This has been a question I've been asking since I was 4 years old. Why can't it? Suffering.
I like the word incompleteness sometimes. It works.
Yeah, that it's not complete. It's not whole. So in Buddhism, we understand that these marks are important to understand existence and reality and to live a fulfilled life, actually. We have to penetrate this, not here so much, but the whole being has to penetrate these three marks of existence. And accepting these three marks of existence, really accepting them, which is, trust me, I think a lifelong endeavor. This allows us kind of to be happy, even in the midst of our frustration and unhappiness. We can still be somehow content in the middle of it. It's a way of moving with this ever-changing stream, as opposed to being oppositional with life and saying, it just has to conform to what I need for me to be happy. Because I'm sorry, I'm probably not the first to show you that it's not the way life delivers itself. It's not going to give you exactly what you want. It's going to give you an opportunity to expand what you think is okay. So understanding these three marks of existence illuminates another of the foundational Buddhist teachings, which is all conditioned things, that means everything that exists, is interconnected, wildly, vastly interconnected. This is pratisamutpada, a Sanskrit term that means dependent origination, or dependent arising. And it shows us that all of us are in this room right today because of very complicated, basically unfathomable causes and conditions in all of our histories since the beginning of time. It kind of blows your mind. You would not be here, but for everything that ever happened before now. This doctrine of interconnection, interbeing, Thich Nhat Hanh calls it. I like that a lot. Basically is explaining to us that if this exists, that exists. If this ceases to exist, that ceases to exist. It is the basis of the Buddha's teachings on birth and death. And it explains direct causes, indirect causes of everything that we experience. So this interplay, this wildly vast interconnection that brought us all into this room right now. Everything exists due to those causes and conditions. And they're all intertwined with all other causes and conditions. In a weird way, we're all related right now. because we're meeting here right now. We are a little family right now. Everything that ever existed brought us together right now. So from the perspective of this vast, complicated, mysterious, and unfathomable array of causes and conditions, we have to understand that our existence, our choices, each one of us individually and collectively, are a product of that stream, and our action makes a difference. All of their actions brought us here. So our existence is entirely dependent on everything else and each other. So I think this interbeing has both an internal component and an external component. And since you all are voting on Tuesday, if you are registered to vote, I will not talk about politics except in this very grand way, which is to say, I think you all can understand that how a country acts, big country, affects itself more than anything else. It affects its internal workings. But there's no doubt that what happens on Tuesday affects the whole world, right? The same thing applies to any family, any social group, any intentional community like Jokoji. What we do here, those of us who live here, affects us, affects this community very profoundly. But guess what? It's affecting you too, right here, right now. So there's this all the time together. And of course, this holds true for each of you. Sorry. But your individual actions belong to you. They're all that belong to you. Your individual actions, your speech, your behavior, your compassion for yourself, all of these things affect you principally. They affect you. And guess what? They affect me. They affect everyone in the world, everywhere you go. Even the ideas and the opinions and the judgments you hold in your mind, even if they're never expressed out of your mouth, they are expressed inside your mind and your body. Even they have their own consequences. So the four noble truths, the four ennobling truths of our teachings are centered around this understanding that our experience of life is subject to these three marks of existence, and our delusion about these three marks of delusion. And that removing those delusions, kind of pulling the veil back and understanding there is non-self, there is impermanence, and there is dis-ease, not disease, dis-ease, unease, or incompleteness, a sense of incompleteness. Then we pull that veil back. That is the end of suffering. So by integrating this understanding in your own choices every moment of the day, you become kind of intimate with every choice you make. And life becomes this extended appreciation. In the midst of all the stuff that's here, there's this incredible appreciation for this cup. How did it form? Do you realize all the forces that brought this cup to us? The water, clean water. I mean, it goes on and on. You can do this all day long.
And it's empty of own cup being. So something can be inside it. Right.
Right. So I'm going to have a sip and I'm going to really enjoy it.
How was it?
So imagine that when you're stuck in traffic, the miracle of your existence, of being stuck in traffic. I mean, you were born at the right time, right? He doesn't like being in queues at all. I find them incredibly wonderful. I'm like waving to all the people in traffic and they're flipping me off, by the way. But I really feel connected to them all because we're on the boat together. And it's really obvious because the boat is stalled. But, you know, your mileage may vary. So if we understand existence through these marks of existence, we begin to slow down, slowing down, slowing down, slowing down, and noticing the cup and noticing all of your beautiful faces. And something brought you here today. If we can accept our experience as it is, just as it is, with this deep appreciation that there's no fixed person who's having this experience, that she's changing as we speak, that there's no impermanence about the experience itself as well, and that some of it's going to involve old age, sickness, and death, as the Buddha first noticed, but some suffering. There's just this tremendous beauty in this understanding. And it goes on and on forever. Life itself is calling us to embrace it as it is, this whole beautiful mess. Didn't you have a koan up your sleeve?
A koan?
You did have a koan.
Okay. Do people know what a koan is? A koan, it's from the wonderful teaching tradition in China, in the Chan. This is called a Zen center. So the word Zen is the Japanese translation of the word Chan. And there was a practice tradition in China called the Chan tradition, which like Zen, really emphasized meditation itself. And what's that called? Oh, who is that one?
Yeah. Okay.
As you just mentioned, in this investigation, and it's an investigation we're doing right now collectively, but it's an investigation you're all doing individually, you know, like what is real, what is existence. We have to acknowledge that we're an agent. In other words, like we have agency, we have authority. We are, they say sometimes when you sit on this cushion, you're, watch out because you're a Buddha. You know, in other words, like you mentioned about driving a car. So it's like you're driving the car when you're on this cushion, you're steering. It's not like you're on a bus and someone else is driving for you. Someone, you know, in charge, you know, who tells you what the truth is, you know, you have to find out the truth for yourself. So this is a lot of information about basic Buddhism, but the invocation of the Buddha and the invocation of all the teachers that preceded him was, this is direct experience. You have to find out the direct experience for yourself. In other words, you're the boss. I like the term, you're the sovereign of your life. You know, you're the queen, you're the king, you have dignity, you own your place. So here's a little koan from Munmun, from the Chan tradition in China. It's called, Who Is That One? And Munmun asked his assembly, he had a vast assembly of monks and nuns, and he said, even Shakyamuni Buddha, the original Buddha, and Maitreya Buddha, the Buddha of potentiality, the Buddha of the future, even the Buddha that started this whole practice tradition, and the Buddha that personifies the potentiality in you to bring forward the practice in your daily life. Even Shakyamuni and Maitreya Buddha are servants of someone. I ask you, he's asking the assembly, I ask you, who is that one? Or another way to put it is, I ask you, assembly, even the Buddha, even the original Buddha and the Buddha yet to be, are accountable to someone. Who is that one? And as the story comes down, no one answered it. But can anyone answer that? Does anyone have an answer? Raise your hands.
It's not a trick.
Yes. Even the Buddha, the Buddha that preceded you and the Buddha yet to be within you are in service to you, you know? So we like to say, you know, sometimes people go to a church or a temple or whatever, you know, and they think they should serve the temple, you know, or the temple, or they're in service to the temple. No, it's the other way around. The temple is in service to you. Temple, this whole setup here is for human existence, you know? I mean, we're on this delicate little thing between life and death, you know? It's very temporal. We only have one chance. It's a one-way road, you know? I mean, we don't want to mess around with this. And so this is for us, you know? So find out what works for you. Experiment, you know? You're the boss. You're the sovereign of your life. So sit down and investigate your life and ask, what is existence? And if you can, fulfill it. And the Buddha recommended, as you taught, the Buddha recommended how to fulfill your life, how to make your life, buddhadhammaya, a fulfilled life, you know, to make it complete. You see things as they are, or better yet, you see things how they come into being. So it's kind of a mistake to say, it's kind of a mistake of language to say, see things as they are, because it sounds like things are fixed. The Buddha did not say, see things as they are. He said, see things as they come into being, as they arise, and what's the truth of impermanence? They
go away.
They go away, yeah. See the origin factors and dissolution factors of all dharmas, of all phenomena. See that clearly, if you can. See the truth. Don't miss your life. That's the invocation of Buddhism. Don't miss your life. And do it now. And remember, it's intimate, it's close at hand. Okay.
I think we should end there. That's perfect. Please don't waste your life. And I see already that we have a question. Michael, can you?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for a very good and illuminating talk. But I guess I would comment when you said I'm in charge of my life, I'm in charge of my actions. But I'm not. Everything affects me. If my actions affect everyone else, then everyone else's actions affect me. What happens around me, I respond to, but I mean, I don't have control over my society. I have control of my actions, but I don't have control over anything else. So these other factors, this coming instability, whatever it is going to have profound effects on me. I'm not controlling that. I can't control that. All I can control is my response. So I would think I'm not really in control of my life. If as you say, I affect everyone else, then everyone else affects me because we're all interdependent. It's kind of like, you know, one death diminishes all, as well as one birth lifts us up. So how can I be in complete charge? I think really all I can control is my response and my own actions, and don't take it all too seriously kind of thing. But what do you think about that?
Well, Shoho just said, yes, that's it. You've got agency over your response. And I think everyone will agree with you. That's what you really have in your dominion and control. But nobody ever suggested you were doing this alone. Mm. And in fact, we're not ever doing anything alone. And so, yeah, it's like a big web of interconnection. But what you do is under your control. What you do with what life delivers is completely under your dominion. It is. Your response, if it is wholesome, for example, or not so wholesome, makes a difference to your experience and the entire fabric of experience. So you're in charge of you. And therefore, spreading that outward forever, and it has its effects. You know, in the sutra, we chant almost every morning, spreading compassion over the entire world. How about we just do that and see what happens as our response to all of the mess, spreading compassion over the entire world.
Also, I think being present, being in place, you could say being your own agent. Maybe that sounds a little grand. Maybe just say being in place. From there, you can do what you said. You can appropriately respond and understand the conditionality of your actions and other actions, and how interwoven everything is together. And actually knowing that will make you very, very skillful and attuned to what's appropriate and how to make this gesture to existence. And you will, if you're in place, if you're your own being, your own agent, you could say you can make this appropriate response and make this interconnected gesture and perhaps fulfill your life. Good luck.
Thank you, Michael-san, for asking this. It also makes me want to reiterate something I think I said earlier, which is by practicing, really practicing in every moment, not just Zazen, but Zazen in particular, but in practicing in life, being what Shoho just mentioned, in place in each moment, in place. This is what's right before me right now. We develop this sense of happiness that is not contingent on external events. That's what happens. It just happens. It's not like you can go grab it. It happens with practice, which is why it's called a practice. It's not once and done, friends. It's a practice. And this sense of happiness or wholeness or okayness with everything the world is delivering, no matter what's outside, this balanced state of mind that we call equanimity often in our practice, a balanced state of mind, equanimous. And it is very resilient mind and body. Oh, I will deal with whatever comes because I can, because I'm in charge of my response. It's an incredibly powerful thing. Even if we're all victims of life, because life is in charge, we're in charge of our response. It is not a little thing to really pick up those reins. It is a huge thing, and it is the Buddha's teaching. Take it. It's your only chance, as far as we know. Okay, that was the bell. If there are any other questions that are burning, please feel free to ask them now or forever hold your peace. Randy, no, do you have a question, Rand? I think I can unmute you. Let's see. There you go.
Yeah, real quick, I unmuted it. Maybe it's just a thing of limitation of language, but you know, you talk about accepting our existence as it is. But at the same time, so much of our life is trying to change our existence, doing things to make things better, or to do this, or to become a Buddhist, or to go to a Shishin, or it. And then maybe I'm nitpicking, but I don't, you know, accepting our existence as it is. And I know that's moment to moment, but we also make decisions on our thinking about things like, I don't like what's going on right now. I want to change something. I want to do this. I want to do. So that just seems to be the human experience. And at the same time, you get from, you know, Zen accepting things as it is. And, well, it makes me scratch my head. And so that's my conundrum, I guess. I don't know if it's anyone else's. But
I think you just described reality.
That's all I
did you hear me? I think that you just described the way it is, which is
no, I didn't.
You see things
as they come to be,
and you respond.
Which means you'll be changing.
Which means you'll be part of the big flow of change. Everything's changing, and now you are casting a vote, so to speak, in the direction that you feel is the most wholesome and the most beneficial for you and for all beings. I don't see any conflict. Maybe it's the word accepting that's getting on your nerves, but you could use another word, receiving. One of our teachers, Chiazon Sensei, was here recently, and he used this word that I loved. How about if you receive what's right here? Receive it.
Accepting feels static.
I don't know. And it also seems like it has a judgment, right?
It feels set in stone or something. I don't know. But and again, language is, I think, always kind of a little bit of a problem in this practice of not.
Well, let's practice receiving.
Hitting the head on the nail, or the nail on the head.
Let's practice with receiving what's right in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And not taking it too personally. Thank you. Yeah, we have to go practice receiving lunch now. Thank you, dear friends out in Zoom land. Thank you, dear friends here. We're going to finish with this gatha after the talk.
Thanks, Georgia.